You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. What do you know about Albania? You know where it is, don't you? You know the boot of Italy? And just to east of that, the Adriatic Sea? And just across that Adriatic Sea is Albania. Southern border is with Greece. Its northern border is with Montenegro. And Kosovo, it's just to the northeast. Not a very big country. But there's a very significant story about it that has a great deal to do with the Catholic Church. Albania prides itself on its fierce national Catholic identity and long Catholic history. The faith first came to the area that makes up the modern state by way of the missionary journeys of St. Paul, and of course other early leaders of the church. Bishops from the region were very prominent in some of the very early church councils. This country has produced some great Catholics, like St. Jerome, the scholar who first translated the New Testament into Latin, and Pope Clement XI, and Mother Teresa of Calcutta. She was Yugoslavian, but she had an Albanian heritage. Albania suffered greatly under fascism, as all nations subjected to the Axis powers did during World War II. But its worst horrors were reserved for the period after the war, when the new Communist People's Republic of Albania was created. That was January of 46, 1946. Now, communism came in with a lot of promises. They promised relief from the terrors that fascism has inflicted on that poor country. Indeed, the Communist Constitution of Albania contained guarantees of freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and freedom of religion. But as in all communist states, these rights existed only on paper. In hard reality, it was only the witness of those who resisted the daily violation of their rights and beliefs, including many Catholics who were persecuted to the point of martyrdom, that kept the most basic of human ideals alive. During this period, they did everything in its power to stamp them out. Let's step backward and put your time boots on. The history of Albania is pretty complex. It was a Catholic nation until its subjection by the Ottoman Turks, the Muslims, in the 15th century. Various waves of political turmoil have sent Albanians into several other countries, including Greece, the Balkans, Italy. As a matter of fact, one famous immigrant became Pope Clement XI, as I mentioned before. His name was Gianfrancesco Albani, an Albanian. His family went to Italy as refugees. Over 1 million Albanians live in parts of former Yugoslavia, and almost as many in modern Turkey. Albania's long ties with Italy have led almost 250,000 refugees living in that country. Turkish dominance over half a millennia created a Muslim majority. Two-thirds of Albanians today are Muslims. 19% are Orthodox Christians, with long ties to Byzantium. And about 13%, mostly in the north, are Roman Catholics. It was not until 1913, after various arrangements, that the great powers in Europe recognized an independent Albania. World War I put even that precarious agreement in jeopardy. It was largely owing to the influence of our own American President Woodrow Wilson and Pope Benedict XV that an independent Albania emerged, although in somewhat reduced size, after the war. In 1920, Albania joined the League of Nations. Most of the nations in that area came under German influence quickly during World War II, but not Albania. The long Italian connection made an invasion by Mussolini's fascist armies acceptable to other world powers. But resistance to fascism came from many sources, not the least the Albanian Catholic Church. As a matter of fact, the Franciscans published a newsletter called The Morning Star that was highly influential. A Franciscan priest, Father Anton Harapi, distinguished himself in those years for his outspoken opposition to fascist oppression. Harapi had been leader in education and caring for the sick during the years of Albanian independence. Ironically, he would be executed after World War II by the new communist government as a traitor. According to reports, he told the tribunal that condemned him, and I quote him, "If to suffer for the people and with the people and fight for the faith in the fatherland are considered weakness and treason, then not only myself, but all the Albanian Franciscans deserve the great honor of being shot." He died blessing and forgiving his executioners. There were people who wanted a different future after the war, but communist resistance forces played a cruel game on them. At first, communists refrained from attacking Germans, while the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact between the Soviets and the Nazis was in force. When that pact dissolved, 1941, they went into action against not only the big lingering fascist and Nazi forces. There was a man named Hoxha, Enver Hoxha, and he was the communist leader. And he announced that other nationalistic anti-Nazi forces should be, quote, exterminated without pity, unquote. Actually, they were aided by the Yugoslav material and training that they received, and even the British material and training. And both these nations would soon regret their involvement. The communists followed the retreating German forces with bloody purges. They had a great deal of opposition in northern Albania, where its high concentration of Catholics were aided by the strong ecclesial structure. Hoxha took power in 1944. He continued to the 40s until his death in the 80s. And he paid indirect homage to the Albanian Catholic Church, even as he described the party's goals. I'll quote him. Hoxha said, "The Catholic clergy is influential in the ancient northern capital of Skoroda and the surrounding region. Its influence cannot be eliminated by merely administrative measures. The Catholic clergy is a well-organized body. It has strong traditions and close links with the Vatican. Therefore, we should confront its organization with our better organization, confront its policy with our political line, and oblige it to fight on our ground and not on its own. We must find the right method of struggle and appropriate tactics to use against the Catholic clergy." That struggle, it would soon become clear, would involve persecution, expropriation of property, the wholesale slaughter of the Catholic leadership, and an attempt to create a new kind of state. It was to be the first atheist state on the planet. The Communist Party began its usual tactics. In the first election after the war, it received 93% of the vote in a race that permitted only communist candidates. The Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc nations officially recognized the new government. But the United States and Great Britain, seeing the direction in which Albania was heading, withdrew their diplomats before a year had passed. Those two nations, along with Italy, even prepared an invasion to free Soviet-dominated Albania. But the effort failed when the Soviets learned of the plan ahead of time through a man who is one of history's most remarkable spies in British intelligence, the infamous Kim Philby. The invasion went off, but the invaders were quickly captured, and their families and friends were arrested and persecuted. Even the ties to the Soviet Union were not sufficiently radical for the Albanian communist leaders. When Nikita Khrushchev took power, that was 1953, he denounced what he called the crimes of Stalinism and maneuvered mass opinion in that direction. His stance caused problems for leaders who had followed and wished to continue the Stalinist line. Albania switched its primary allegiance from the Soviet Union to the new communist regime in China, which took a different, more hardline tack under Chairman Mao Zedong than did the new Soviet leaders. It was even Albania that proposed communist China for membership in the United Nations and a place on the Security Council. When the Chinese implemented the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, Albania followed suit and began a reign of terror against all opposition groups, but most especially against our beloved Catholic Church. So my subject of this program does concentrate on this particular persecution and this reign of terror against the Catholic Church in Albania. And this movement in history left the victims of Albanian communism without a strong voice in the free world. An estimated 35,000 people were executed and 40,000 were given life sentences in this process. More Albanians died at the hands of the communist government in peacetime than had died in World War II. Anti-Soviet Albania was not an issue in Cold War negotiations with Russia, and communist China was not important enough to the West, until the 70s actually, to make it worth trying diplomatic tactics on behalf of Albania. So the persecuted people were left in total isolation, with little information about their plight leaking to the outside world. Albanians of all denominations, but especially the Catholics, suffered truly terrible persecutions. The Holy See spoke boldly through the Vatican Radio about this plight, and it was one of Albania's few defenders in the free world. Even the Greek Orthodox Church and the Islamic League were silent for political reasons. When the Vatican did this, the regime denounced them as fascist. The Vatican, they claimed, was fascist. Albanians caught listening to the Vatican Radio would receive a stiff prison sentence. The Albanian communists had good reason to pay attention to the church. In addition to a strong ecclesial structure, Franciscans and Jesuits had played a major role in modern Albanian culture. The Franciscans got there early, well, as early as St. Francis returned from Syria in 1219. And they made their presence felt through the education of Albanians of various religious backgrounds and through publishing projects of a scholarly
and, as a matter of fact, also of a sort of popular magazine nature. So we'll talk more about Albania after the break on breadboxmedia.com. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting record straight about what was incredibly the world's first atheist nation state.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Before the break, we were talking about Albania, communist Albania, which was really the creation of it, was the creation of the world's first atheist state, the first atheist nation. All nations, all tribes even, have religion. And it takes a great deal of effort to create a state or nation without it. It takes a great deal of suppression. It takes a lot of killing, actually. But we were talking about the arrival of the Franciscans in the 1200s, about the time of St. Francis. What about the Jesuits? Well, the Jesuits did not arrive in Albania until the 19th century, but they helped promote the teaching of Albanian and, as a byproduct, Albanian nationalism in a nation still influenced by the Ottoman Empire. The Jesuits organized the seminary that trained all the Albanian priests, and the College of St. Xavier, one of the premier institutions of higher education in Albania. And as you might expect, that wherever the Jesuits are, there's publications. So they created a vigorous publishing program in Albania. There were other orders, Cilicians, Servites, and these orders established communities of nuns. And the nuns ran hospitals, kindergartens, trade schools. The religious orders were integrated into the very heart of the national life. Very important part of the fabric of it. So, and when the communist governments took over, one of the first things they did was erase the historic role of these orders, erase them from the textbooks, the history textbooks. Small countries like Albania usually have a tiny intellectual and political elite who serve multiple functions, like diplomats, politicians, writers, and journalists. In Albania, those who had performed those tasks in the previous 100 years were either priests, and many of them contributed to the renaissance of Albanian culture earlier in the centuries, poets, ethnologists, historians, and composers. Or if they weren't priests, they'd been trained by Catholic institutions, which also accepted Orthodox and Muslim students. And in the longer vistas of Albanian history, it was the Catholic Church that loomed as the largest cultural factor in the nation. So whenever we back off and start to take a high altitude, a broad view of Albanian history, it's the Catholic Church that is the premier cultural institution. Besides that, in the heavily Catholic north part of the country, missionaries labored to end the Sicilian type of vendettas common among the tribal people. They improved the status of women, long relegated to subordinate roles by Islamic influences. So they raised the status of women. There's a non-Catholic and communist collaborator named Ismail Kadar, and he was one of Albania's best-known 20th century writers during the worst period of the dictator Hoxha. He observed, "Our culture has been in large part founded on the Catholic tradition, and even the Turkish invasion could not remove that impression. Here in Albania, all the great writers, with very few exceptions, have been Catholic, while Islam, despite centuries of occupation, has had an influence that may be passed over in silence." So wrote this famous writer, who was certainly an opponent and not a friend of the Catholic Church. But he was fair-minded enough to say that. To eliminate all these figures from national history was tantamount to obliterating Albanian culture. This quote was quite a praise for the Catholic Church, wasn't it? For the works of the Catholic Church, the earthly works, the promulgation of culture. But the regime wanted atheism, and it filled the void it created with portrayals of itself as the only guarantee of national identity, and with charges that earlier periods were marked by Italian imperialism. And they talked a lot about the supposed priestly collaboration in the Vatican and fascism and Nazism of various types. These lies were large and absurd, but they were the only information formally available to Albanian students for almost two generations. So this Albanian totalitarian regime also tried to obliterate all record of its crimes against the people, and especially those crimes against the Catholic Church. But enough has remained through living memory and sporadic written records that the long and perhaps unmatched suffering of Albanian Catholics can be reconstructed in its large lines, if not in detail. From the start, Hoxha's new regime practiced a two-track policy toward the church, harsh treatment followed by invitations to apostasy. Even before the formation of the new government, persecution began. Catholic publishing houses were closed and journalists were silenced almost immediately. Catholic Action and other Catholic groups were branded fascist and broken up. One bishop was expelled as a, quote, undesirable, and the apostolic delegate was arrested, mistreated, and deported back to Italy. Catholic kindergartens, schools, orphanages, and hospitals were confiscated. They taught dialectical materialism. You know dialectical materialism. It's sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the communist movement around the world. Still goes on. Well, in Albania, dialectical materialism became the required subject. Even the College of St. Xavier had to accept communism and communist professors. Two Jesuits who protested, that was Father Gardin and Brother Vata, were arrested and sentenced to hard labor. Amid these initial pressures, Hoxha met with Albanian archbishops and offered better treatment in exchange for their definitive break with Rome and the transformation of Albanian Catholicism into a national church subservient to the government. Well, the hierarchy of the Albanian Catholic Church refused this offer. They didn't want better treatment in exchange for the freely believed practice of our Catholic faith. Something similar is going on in slow motion in China today over recent decades. You know what's different now? Is the media is actually everyone. Everyone with an Android or iPhone or any kind of device that accesses the internet. It's making changes in the world. It's breaking up the European Union. A lot of decentralization of authority and power is occurring. The Catholic Church would call it subsidiarity, keeping power concentrated at the lowest practical level. Well, what happened then was terrible, but it's doubtful whether even such a betrayal of their vows, and Albania's history too, would have saved the church much suffering. The Albanian communists had early on decided on a crusade to eliminate religion totally in the country, to make it vanish. To be able to carry out this mission without witnesses to the outside world, they rounded up and expelled foreign clergy, and that was mostly Italian clergy. In 45, the regime outlawed the Jesuit order and all its institutions. In 47, the Franciscans were banned. Propaganda campaigns, of course, were mounted to make it appear as if all of these steps were taken for justifiable political reasons. So what about the religious orders? Well, they said they were involved in plots, said they were servants of foreign tyrannies. They sought to wreck the socialist future of Albania. All the usual communist approaches, disinformation and lies. Though the ploy was transparent abroad, it worked to a degree in many non-Catholic areas in Albania, primarily because the government controlled all media and other sources of information. In the first years of the new government, the number of acts of persecution started a steep climb. Sudden executions, arrest and torture became instruments of terror. Judicial proceedings, when they took place, were often merely show trials. At times, they were broadcast live over the radio. One such broadcast went awry in 48, when a man named Pierin Chira, who was a former member of the Sigurimi, the Albanian secret service, he blurted out this. And this was in a live radio broadcast from a courtroom. He blurted out these words. "You are the most wretched people in the world. I've received orders from you to torture the people, to fabricate slander against the Catholic clergy. I, your blind instrument, as cowardly and criminal as you, have done all that was in my power to carry out your orders. You commanded me to go at night to hide arms in the churches and monasteries, so you would have a pretext to eliminate the clergy and to destroy the Catholic Church. I confess to the entire Albanian people that I have carried out your orders with great diligence and secrecy. My personal disgrace is not important to me. Instead, I detest having been a vile instrument in your hands and of having betrayed the blood of so many innocent members of the Catholic clergy." Well, the radio crew rushed and cut off the transmission at this point. When the station came back on the air, Chira was receiving a death sentence. According to reports, he was immediately executed, and his body was thrown into the same common graves as the priests he had betrayed. That was an act of amazing heroism and courage. There were other similar stories. Here's one. Two Franciscans, one named Luli, one named Harapi, and two secular priests, Shantoya and Zadeya, were quickly executed. Shantoya was so badly tortured before he died, his forearms and leg bones broken. He could only sort of walk around on elbows and knees. His own mother asked his captors to kill him rather than continue the torture. Before the new government was even officially formed, several Jesuits were given long sentences to hard labor. Others were rounded up on the flimsiest of pretexts. Jesuit Vice Provincial John Fausti, a seminary rector, De Jani, and a Franciscan editor of the Morning Star were all accused of subversion and fascism and executed. In a perverse show of impartiality, the Albanian government also executed the Muslim lawyer who had chosen out of conscience to defend many of the Jesuits and Franciscans. I ask you to pardon me that some of these stories are rather upsetting, I know that. But they're also inspiring at the same time. To think how casually sometimes we regard a Catholic faith, when it has meant so much to other people who went through terrible persecutions and death for the sake of our beloved Catholic faith. This is Charles Coughlin. There's more stories like this after the break on BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
The program is setting the record straight. We're back after the break. This is Chuck Coughlin, of course. I was sharing with you some stories. They're terrible to hear, and they burden my heart as it must yours. But they also inspire my soul to have a true appreciation of the value of our Catholic faith and what other Catholics have gone through to not abandon that Catholic faith. I was telling you some stories about these persecutions in communist Albania. One of the most notorious instances involved Vincent Prenducci, a Franciscan who had risen to become Archbishop of Durrës. Now, Father Prenducci had been a student of Albanian folklore. He'd published several collections of traditional songs and poetry. He wrote poetry himself and translated into Albanian some of the best poems of other European languages. But his great cultural contribution and religious eminence only sped up his arrest in 1947 by the fledgling communist regime. He was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor. He was also subjected to beatings and savage torture in prison. At one point, he was tied up and hung from the prison bathroom ceiling. The archbishop was 65 years old at the time. As if this was not enough, one day he was forced to work in a work detail, carrying logs up a hill. Guards loaded the old priest's shoulders with a burden he obviously could not carry. He fell repeatedly while the guards and director laughed at him. He remained silent. After various episodes of mistreatment, his health failed, and he ended up in the prison hospital with heart problems and asthma. A fellow prisoner records that he spent his final several months gasping for breath with little medical attention, and only a limited amount of fuel allotted to stay warm. Those who were with him at the end, however, felt that something they had seen in him alive bore witness to an immortal element that survives the death of the body. All this occurred during one of the periods of great persecution. I'll tell you another story. It happened around the same time as the one we just told you. There was a bishop, Franno Gini, and the Franciscan provincial, Ciprianica. They were machine gunned, along with around 20 other clergy. Bishop Gini had already braved serious threats when he was appointed abbot of the church in Merdita region during political and social turmoil there. This was about 1929. With the creation of the communist regime, he was again asked to undertake a dangerous task when he replaced Leone De Nigris as a substitute apostolic delegate for Albania. Since this region was heavily Catholic, it resisted the imposition of the communist rule, and the communists blamed Bishop Gini. The dictator, Hoxha, tried to pressure him into convincing Catholics to join with the government and break off with the Vatican. Well, it was a tactic bound to fail with a man whom the other Albanian bishops had chosen to be their official link with Rome. Bishop Gini issued a statement protesting official slanders against the church and persecution. He knew in advance what the response would be. And he got it. He got the response he knew was coming. They arrested him. They tied him up and administered electric shocks. Then they got serious. He was cut in various places, and the wounds were irritated with salt. Wood splinters were driven under his fingers and toenails. Finally, he was shot and dumped in a mass grave without any judicial review at all. As has often been the case in periods of direct persecution, instead of intimidating the Catholics of that region, the Merdita region, the brutal but heroic death of this man inspired the people to greater resistance against the growing tyranny. The other man I mentioned, Ciprianica, also fell in the same wave of repression. It was 1946. He was accused of hiding arms in a Franciscan convent. Well, the charge was obviously false because the arms had been planted. One of Father Nika's fellow prisoners who survived the camps reports that they were often taken for torture and interrogation. During this whole period, Nika maintained a deep spiritual and emotional tranquility. One of the guards' favorite pastimes was to discuss the existence of God with Father Nika during the torture sessions. Though he and the other prisoners knew it was only intended as a mockery of religion, he took it as his duty to make the case for the Creator. In one of the final sessions, a guard told him, "My God is Enver Hoxha," just before Nika was beaten unconscious. He was shot shortly after. Another bishop, his name was George Falash, and he was from the Diocese of Sapa. had the distinction of becoming the youngest bishop in the world in 1940. He was 36 years old. And the youngest bishop to be martyred 7 years later. So obviously talented, a man quickly drew the attention of the communist government. His carefully nuanced criticisms of the regime's abuse of human rights led to his being forbidden to participate in religious events, and finally to house arrest. When the restrictions were relaxed, he preached notably in the sanctuary of the Madonna of Shkodra, a favorite place of pilgrimage in Albania. He asked all Albanians, Catholic and not, to be witnesses to the truth in their various homes. He soon was subjected to the familiar pattern, arrest, torture, and being shot. It seems clear that the government had planned to liquidate the Catholic hierarchy from the first. By 1948, one bishop was left alive outside of prison, and he probably survived because he was hiding in the northern mountains. Ordinary priests felt the persecution, too. An even more brutal fate awaited Father Nicol Grazuli, a pastor in the Shkodra Archdiocese. Grazuli fled to resistance forces in the mountains when the communist persecution became too heavy. He was tricked into returning to administer extra unction to a dying villager. Betrayed by an informant, he was shot in the back, but it wasn't a mortal wound. As an object lesson to people in the area, he was hung, still alive, in front of the village church for several days. Another priest, Father Jake Bushati, was arrested and tortured. He too was hung up as a warning, but upside down, repeatedly, for several days at a time before he died. Many lay people were tortured and killed for their failure to make public declarations against the so-called crimes of the clergy. An interesting thing happened. There was an unprecedented show of fidelity and courage when whole parishes of Albanian Catholics asked to be arrested in place of their priests. They also met to say the rosary on Sundays in the priest's absence. Others were condemned, rightly or not, for alleged collaboration with anti-communist forces, which might mean anything from political oppression to involvement in providing food and medical care to guerrilla forces. There was a woman, Elena, who was accused of collaborating with anti-communist resistance, and she underwent the usual tortures. She had her hair pulled out and was bound with barbed wire. Her end is unknown to this day. Another woman named Bianca was only 20 years old when she was arrested and suffered all the same tortures and also had all her teeth pulled out. There was a woman, Maria Shalaku, from Kosovo, and she was pronounced too depraved for quick execution by a firing squad. Her tribunal ordered that she and other companions be slowly burned alive to ashes. All this time, nuns were beginning to be expelled from convents and forbidden to wear religious habits. The few remaining religious went virtually underground to administer the sacraments. There was a lot of confiscations of Catholic properties that were turned into public facilities such as theaters, cafes, courtrooms, and even prisons. There was a cathedral that became a basketball court. Sacred vessels were profaned and sold off. By the end of 1949, all religious groups, Muslims and Orthodox included in this, were all required to submit constitutions for state approval. Every one of them ceded control of the states, but not the Catholics. They were the exception. In retaliation, the government appointed as Minister of the Interior this general, General Shihu, who had become notorious for the relish with which he attacked the clergy during a period as a volunteer fighter with a Republican side during the Spanish Civil War. He had one of these bishops beaten and forced the church to sign an agreement removing Albania from Roman institutional control, but permitting a spiritual link, so-called spiritual link. When they finally published the agreement, it had been rewritten, revised without consulting the church, and effectively subordinating it to the state. According to the agreement, schools, churches, and seminaries were supposed to receive state support. Naturally, they did not receive the support, and they were slowly strangled. In prisons and in prison camps, the torture took place in many different forms. One Jesuit survivor recorded in his journal the variations in torture. He said this,
Most of them were beaten on their bare feet with wooden clubs. The fleshy part of the legs and buttocks were cut open, rock salt inserted beneath the skin, and then sewn up again. Their feet placed in boiling water until the flesh fell off. Then those places were rubbed with salt. Their Achilles tendons were pierced with hot wires. Some were hung by their arms for 3 days without food. Put in ice and icy water until nearly frozen, and electrical wires placed in their ears, nose, mouth, genitals, and anus. Burning pine needles placed under their fingernails. Forced to eat a kilo of salt and having water withheld for 24 hours. Boiled eggs put in their armpits. Teeth pulled without anesthetics. Tied by hand vans and dragged. Left in solitary confinement without food or water until almost dead. Forced to drink their own urine and eat their own excrement. Put in pits of excrement up to their necks. Put on a bed of nails and covered with heavy material. Put in nail-studded cages, which were then rotated rapidly. A cat and mouse put down the bodice of a nun. Sisters forced to disrobe and walk naked through the streets. I'm sorry about this, but Catholics everywhere should be witnesses to these people, these wonderful Catholic martyrs. But we can pray over this. Prayers are retroactive. We can pray for these people and be lifted up in inspiration.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Before the break, I was talking about the great inspiration that some of these horrible events that we have been examined provide for us. Examples of courage and fidelity to Christ and to our Catholic faith. As resistance to this kind of thing mounted, the stake struck back even harder. In the 60s, more than a dozen priests were martyred. Titular bishops and vicars were forced to clean the streets and public bathrooms, wear clown outfits with paper signs across their chests saying, "I have sinned against the people." So Hoxha, watching across the border the communist Chinese allies of his, their cultural revolution and how destructive he was, and he called on his own Red Guard, the Albanian Red Guard, and he said, "We must exterminate religious superstition." So they burned, vandalized, and razed to the ground churches, monastery, mosques, and harassed clergy. Toward the end of that year, this was 1967, the government completely outlawed religion. And this, as I've told you in this program, this made Albania the world's first officially atheist state on the planet. By the end of that rampage of 67, 2,169 religious buildings, 2,169 religious buildings have been closed or destroyed, and few clergy of any denomination remain free. It would be almost 25 years after the Berlin Wall fell in 89 before the situation would improve. Secret religious activity, of course, continued in clandestine gatherings and in private homes. But the risk of doing things like this was always high. There's a story about Father Stephen Kirti, who's an Albanian priest born in an area that later became the Yugoslavian province of Kosovo, so famous. He was killed in 72 for merely baptizing a child in prison camp. In typical fashion, the communist government justified the murder when it became known internationally, because the government alleged the 74-year-old was a fascist and Nazi, as well as a, quote, despicable agent of the Anglo-American espionage network, a spy and an informer, and a subversive agent of the Vatican. There are some astonishing leaps of logic among these and other charges against Kirti, beginning with the assumption that to adhere to the Vatican was the equivalent of backing Mussolini, with whom the Vatican had had a tempestuous struggle in Italy. Kirti had already spent 16 years in jail after allegedly
so-called confessing espionage activities after the war. When he was released, said the government, he had been engaged in one of the cardinal anti-communist sins, that is, trying to disrupt and sabotage production. It was for crimes against the people, not for baptizing a baby, that he was executed. The statement even justified the early closing of all religious institutions on similar grounds. All the priests, whether Catholic or Orthodox or Muslims, were forced to go to work and earn an honest living. Unquote. Well, yes, yet religious instruction, masses, ordinations, and even the secret consecration of bishops continued under these daily threats. In fact, the regime remained irritated throughout its decades of misrule that party members were not zealous enough in stamping out what they called superstition, Catholicism. Superstition. The primary means by which religious instruction continued was the family. As elsewhere in communist countries, the Albanian government declared the family, quote, reactionary, unquote, and tried to get children to inform on whether their parents were giving them religious instruction at home. It forbade parents to give children religious names. A family saying the rosary together at home could get 5 years in prison. Teaching a child the sign of the cross might bring a similar penalty. Their mere possession of religious literature could lead to a death sentence. Surprisingly, many families still celebrate Christmas and Easter, continued to pray and transmitted their Catholic identity quietly, very quietly to the children. The youngest who might be tricked into divulging information by teachers had to be exposed only slowly and at the right age to these clandestine ways of keeping the faith alive. Miraculously, this worked in most cases, though the government had succeeded in introducing worries about communist spies into the very heart of family life. People were worried that their own teenagers might be spies against them. Much has happened in China during the Cultural Revolution when children turned in their parents en masse. The proof that not only clergy but ordinary lay people remained faithful is that when the first public religious services were permitted again in 1990, they immediately became events where thousands gathered. Part of the Albanian spirit can be glimpsed in the way that Albania's only cardinal in 2,000 years of Catholic history returned to his duties. His name was Cardinal Michael Codicchi. He was nicknamed the Iron Man. He returned to rebuild his cathedral at Shkodra and to begin publishing his weekly paper with a naturalness as if he had been away for only a weekend. Codicchi had been forbidden to perform any public service for 56 years, 37 of which he spent in prison camps. The government agreed to return religious properties in 1991, the same year that Mother Teresa made a brief visit and opened the first convent for nuns in Albania. Since when? 1967. 1983, the regime compared John Paul II to Mussolini. In 1993, it received him as a distinguished world leader who has spoken out in defense of the Albanian people for 15 years. The Albanian people and the Albanian church triumphed, but it was at a very high price, a dear price. Out of 156 priests before the persecution began, 65 were martyred and 64 died during or after imprisonment. Tens of thousands of common people died for religious reasons. Basic knowledge of the faith also perished in large segments of the population. That was for the lack of teachers, and paganism, superstitions, and indifference grew in the absence of the church structures. The ultimate effect of all of this on Albania remains to be seen. But there is no people on earth who passed through a worse time of testing in the 20th century. In the nature of things, few people know about the history of communist Albania. But all of us ought to. Many more of us ought to. As Pope John Paul II told the Albanians, history has never seen before what happened in Albania. Dear Albanians, Your drama must interest the whole European continent. Europe must not forget. I know the you and I hope that such things never happen again, but they are happening again right now. Persecution of Catholics and all Christians increases around the world. The words that are often said are convert or die like Christ. Those words from the most flagrant religious oppression in the world at the dawn of a new millennium might serve as an epitaph for all the hundreds of thousands who suffered persecution and death in the 20th century. Or for that matter, since the very beginnings of Catholicism, Christ made a point of telling his followers, "They have persecuted me, and they will persecute you." And the Gospel of John, after noting that Jesus knew what was in human hearts, records that the Master said this, "The light has come into the world, and people love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil." It has never mattered much whether the rejection of light came from moral, religious, or political evils. All evils have a common root, and the results have everywhere appeared to be very much the same, wherever the forces of light and the forces of darkness clash. So martyrdoms have not come to an end in this third millennium. The rule of law and democratic procedures, desirable as they are, will not be adequate to abolish sin, but merely make it more difficult for malefactors to gain control of power and wield it. The age-old struggle over things that are Caesar's and the things that are God's is going to go on. It's going to go on forever, to the end of times. The very revelation of that truth has been one of Catholicism's greatest contributions to a world in which various powers, political, religious, cultural, etc., are always seeking to exert total control over human life. The martyrs stake their lives on a truth beyond all human powers. There's no other group of victims throughout history who so consistently faced terrifying ends with calm hope and sincerely forgave their persecutors. Martyrs rarely even assume a posture of moral superiority toward their executioners, people that most of us would regard as inhuman monsters. The martyrs are aware of the evil in themselves and the redemption that has come to them from outside the usual human darkness. By the specific dynamics of martyrdom, the desire for vengeance or sense of superiority are ruled out from the beginning. For a Catholic, martyrs are not merely models to be imitated, but like all saints, spirits with whom we are in communion, waiting with a common hope. Let us be in communion with these people that I've discussed in this program. Martyrdom is, in a deep sense, a paradigm for the Catholic life. Any person who starts to follow the Master seriously cannot help but find himself or herself attacked by the same forces that attacked him. For from that willingness to die springs everything and makes it worthwhile to live. And so, let us end with this prayer. Requiem aeternam dona eis Domine, et lux perpetua luceat eis. For Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin. Thanks for listening.